One of the consequences of the Iranian Islamic Revolution of 1979 was a cultural revolution where any discussion of the pre-Islamic Persian empires became taboo. Although there are no similar prohibitions in the West, much of this ancient history remains unknown here as well. A new book, Shadows in the Desert, is a comprehensive history of Persia's wars, which spanned a millennium. The book is by Dr. Kaveh Farouk, and it's published by Osprey. And I'm very pleased to welcome Professor Farouk to my show today. Hello.
Great being here in the show and in New York.
Even today, the curriculum in most Iranian schools doesn't include Persian studies. What is taught?
Well, actually, there's been a lot of revisionism that's happened because a lot of the ideology that propelled the revolution actually is targeted against the pre-Islamic or so-called pagan past of Persia. So there's actually been attempts to almost deny that even this history existed.
Even though it's a history that most countries would be quite proud of.
Yes, but you have to look at the pan-Islamic ideology of the ruling caste, which poo-poos or downplays pre-Islamic Persia because that fell.
So the history books in Iran begin with the birth of Muhammad around 570 AD?
Well, I've asked a lot of questions about that. And what's happening now is if they make reference, the answer is affirmative. But with respect to the past, if there's mention, they're usually presented in a very negative light if they're acknowledged. So like Cyrus the Great or Darius the Great, I met some people who had actually come from Iran a few months ago in Vancouver. And they actually viewed some of their past, let's just say, glories in a very negative light. But these would be people who were more sort of ideologically close to the regime, which is not really the mainstream youth, which is actually moving in the opposite direction, which is a good thing.
Why has the name Iran replaced Persia as the name of the area? That's not related to this, is it?
Well, no, this goes back to probably the 1930s, where...
So it's that recent?
It's pretty recent. Although, see, the name Iran would be the old Iranian name for Persia, because Persia comes from Persia, the Greek equivalent. And actually, Iran would be the ancient name of Iran, at least how the Iranians would pronounce it. But I think there was a push to kind of push that name to the mainstream West as opposed to Persia.
Mm-hmm. Get rid of the Greek name.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that Iran is really another way of saying Aryan, isn't it? The Indo-European word, which means noble lord or
yes.
freeman or brother
yes.
or something like that.
Yes, yes. There was a bit
of Hitler talked about the Aryan people, but he was not thinking about the Persians at the time.
Well, I think this was that there may have been an influence there because, remember, we are talking about the 1930s. And there was a push, basically, because the new Pahlavi regime wanted to distance itself from the Arabs in some way. And they probably thought that this would be one way of distancing.
Because it's important to point out that we are the Persians or Iranians or whatever are not Arabs. And that creates a real strong sense of distinction.
Yes, a need to distinguish themselves from, quote, the Middle East, if you will.
But one scholar I've read suggests that Zoroastrianism continues to have a strong influence on the Iranian culture, whether it's acknowledged or not. And that distinguishes it not only from other Muslim areas, but even from other Shiite areas.
Well, again, I'd say the affirmative, although some would argue that elements of Zoroastrianism have probably permeated into Shiism, which is what the Sunni opponents of Shiism have sometimes claimed. But the interesting, you made a really good point about Zoroastrianism, because part of the heritage that has been attempted to be stamped out by the, I remember some of the sermons given by some of the mullahs when they came to power was, like, there's a festival called, which is jumping over fire, called Chashambe Suri, which means the celebration of the last Wednesday of the new Iranian New Year, or prior to the new Iranian New Year, where people jump over bonfires and celebrate and so on. And that was really looked down on as a pagan, immature festival and how people must forget it and in favor of pan-Islamic ideology. And that, again, that was the Zoroastrian, any Zoroastrian-type pagan rituals were looked down on.
Well, of course, if we did that in Christian Europe, we would have to get rid of Christmas, which really is comes from a pagan holiday.
Exactly.
Easter, which comes from a pagan holiday.
Exactly.
And we have many other religious holidays that actually have their roots in paganism.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it doesn't mean that Jesus wasn't born or that he wasn't crucified, but they seem to be celebrated just coincidentally at times when there were old pagan holidays.
That's actually quite true. In fact, you made a really good point with Christmas because it's the birth date of, that's celebrated for Jesus in December is the exact same date of the ancient Iranian god Mithras or Mitra. And those celebrations still take place. It's called the Yalda celebrations. Again, it's persisted.
But we're talking about cultural mixes in the ancient world.
Absolutely.
That are we just can't separate anything. Zoroastrianism and Judaism, for example,
oh,
many
absolutely.
People have talked about a lot of links.
The Intercourse, page 46 of Shadows in the Desert, I'm really proud to say they published a picture of the tomb of Esther and Mordecai. Why I'm proud of this is it tells the world that despite the ideology that's been prevalent, the people of Iran have taken great pains to preserve the tomb of Daniel, the tomb of Esther. The interesting thing is the tomb of Esther was located in the ancient Median town of Ecbatana. The town is now called Hamadan, but that street is now called Ecbatana Street.
So some of the ancient monuments have been preserved, but haven't there been pressures to destroy some of those
Absolutely.
Things in the same way that we saw the Taliban destroy some
Yes.
ancient
Yes.
Buddhist monuments?
Actually, there's now a Pasargadae Foundation Preservation Society, which is basically working to collect petitions across the world to preserve the tomb of Cyrus, who... That's threatened because there are projects to build a dam which will flood and engulf basically the tomb of Cyrus. And I'm fond of Cyrus not because of military reasons, but because he was really the first human rights champion, if you will. He had a special fondness for the Jews and Israel, and he made a point to preserve the Jewish traditions, and he ordered, for example, not only the temple to be rebuilt, but he wanted the confiscated Jewish utensils that the Babylonians had confiscated to be returned to Jewish ownership.
My guest is Dr. Kaveh Farooq. He's written a book called Shadows in the Desert, Ancient Persia at Work. It's published by Osprey. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's go back to the beginnings. What do we know about the early people who lived in this region? They're not Arabs, as you say. Were they Indo-Europeans who came in through India?
Well, this is fascinating because there's been so much ideology has gone into the word Aryan and Indo-European. And it's taken a long time to undo the damage the Nazis did with a lot of their bogus scholarship. But what we now know is, again, as you pointed out, regions and peoples have been connected across time. The original people we now think were a group of farmers, a very peaceful society, if you will, who originated in what is now probably Kurdistan and Azerbaijan.
So not nomads.
Not nomads, but farmers at first. Mm-hmm. Colin Renfrew has done a lot of studies in this area. And they spread slowly across Anatolia, then into Greece over thousands of years, and then round the Black Sea, and then they merged with a group of, I don't know if we can call them Ukrainians at the time, but a group of steppe dwellers. And it seems as if as soon as they had tamed the horse, the first people to break the horse were the ancient proto-Ukrainians, if you will, they merged with this incoming flux of farmers from the Near East. And then this mixture creates what we think the proto-Indo-European, the Kurgan society. Big split occurs. One group moves west, forming the Italic peoples, Germanic peoples, and so forth. And then the eastern branch, known as the Satim, if you will, in the Akdam, the Slavic, the Baltic. And then I use the word very, very clinically, Aryan, or let's just say Indo-Aryan, or Eastern Indo-European. There's a split between the Indian and the Iranian, so the Indians move into India. And then we can kind of say that's where the Iranian branch, the Medes and the Persians of the Bible, that we refer to arrive.
And they're not Turkic people either?
Turkic peoples tend to come later in history. We look at Chinese sources. But the fascinating thing about the Turks is they're cultural cousins, I think, of the Iranians. There's been a lot of mixture with the Turks. For example, I think Turkey and Iran today are mirror images of each other. You have Iranian-speaking Kurds on one, you know, on the Turkish side, the majority, which live. And, you know, on my father's side, there were Turkic-speaking Azerbaijanis. I remember my grandparents, whenever they got into a bit of a argument, they would talk in Turkish.
So when we talk about Azerbaijan, Afghanistan, to some degree Turkey, Iran, we're all talking about people who share an awful lot in common.
Absolutely.
That go way beyond the fact that they all rode horses very early in the history of civilization.
Of course, it's a cultural link that transcends, I think, ethnic, racial, or even immediate boundaries of language. Absolutely.
It's a history that leads to some pretty great empires, and yet we've been talking about repression of the story in Iran. It's also pretty much been told in a very distorted way in the West. The West mostly remembers Persian history as a series of defeats to the Greeks, doesn't it? And that ends with Alexander the Great's conquest of the area.
Of course. We don't hear about, for example, what made Persia kind of bounce back. You have the post-Alexandrian Seleucids giving way to the Parthians. But far more interesting, I think, even from a Hollywood point of view. For example, we have movies of Mark Antony with Richard Burton, or Laurence Olivier, or Sir Laurence Olivier, playing Crassus, who crushes Spartacus. And I think it was Douglas, I think, who played the role.
Kirk Douglas is Spartacus.
That's right. He was playing Spartacus. But we don't hear about the after part about Crassus, where he actually attempted to invade Persia, which was under the Parthians, and he was defeated and killed by a force one-third his size. And
you would think in Iran they would want this kind of story told, because these are victories over the West.
Yes, but you see, the problem is they're victories, yes, but so much of Iran was tied to the West and to Judeo-Christianity. So it's a double-edged sword for them. And plus, if you glorify the past, it will also diminish the role of the present government and call into question a lot of their ideology.
Are there museums in Iran that keep these artifacts?
Yes. Amazingly, there are people who have fought very hard. There's still remnants from the past, before this regime. Who have worked very hard to preserve, the museums and so on. It's almost as if the regime or the ideologues know you can't push that far. Like, there was a big protest by the youth wearing T-shirts of Zoroaster. I mean, it was bizarre. Basically shouting in front of the cultural ministry that you cannot bury the tomb of Cyrus. You cannot destroy Bostan site, which carries the first knight, and the Arthurian emblems. There's definitely a definitive, let's just say, cultural resistance among the youth, even though they may not necessarily know. But it's like Persepolis when you visit. There's a feeling of what happened here. And what's amazing is he had ideologues who wanted to dynamite the site in the beginning of the revolution.
Well, we've heard that since the revolution, religions, minority religions, have been persecuted, the Baha'i, the Jews, Zoroastrians as well. I guess that they're called Parsis.
Well, that's something I probably don't have much objective information in terms of statistics and so on. But I would say the persecution that you see runs across the gamut of society. We're all feeling it equally. I think it crosses gender, religious lines, ethnic lines.
So more Parsi wound up living in India than living in their original homeland.
Yes, that would have happened after the Islamic invasions, where they actually migrated to preserve their faith. But amazingly, a Zoroastrian community also survived in Iran and even now.
Now, the language is an Indo-European language.
Yes.
So that means that it has a lot in common with Western languages.
Oh, absolutely.
What happened? What is the language of Iran like today? Is it an Indo-European language?
It is an Indo-European language, but the actual Persian language itself has undergone many phases like English has. What happened after the Islamic invasion, the Pahlavi language, if you will, was apparently suppressed because a lot of the regions that we call the Middle East were not Arab in origin. Like, you had Babylonian spoken, you had Akkadian spoken, you had, in fact, a lot of the places which we now call Palestine, for example, were bastions of Judeo-Christianity. In fact, the Byzantine culture was rooted in what is now Syria, Lebanon, so on, Egypt even. And a lot of the populations basically became Arabic-speaking. I think Albert Hourani, the late Albert Hourani, talks about that quite nicely. With Iran, it's amazing that it didn't happen. It's kind of like what happened in Spain. The oral traditions of the past seem to continue, and then you have a 10th century epic writer, kind of like the Iliad of Persia, the Shahnameh of Ferdowsi, and he basically glorified that past.
But isn't Persian, I guess, now mostly Farsi? Isn't it written with Arabic letters?
The Arabic script was introduced pretty much from probably the 9th century. You start seeing Arabic characters being used to express an Indo-European language. That has posed some problems orthographically, again, in a technical sense, because there are certain sounds that exist in Arabic that don't exist in Persian, for example. And so, like, some redundant symbols for the letter S, like three ways to spell S, for example.
So what's happened? Have compromises been made, or have new letters been invented?
There's a big debate now in the linguists, like whether we should continue with the script, should we go to Latin script? And, kind of, I guess, what the Ottoman Empire went through after, when Ataturk came to power, let's kind of rationalize the script, and they adopted the Latin script. The downside, I guess, for them was they lost touch with a lot of some great literary works in the Ottoman language. But that's been always a hot debate. Myself, I kind of propose at least some kind of reforms to the existing script. There's so much literature that's been written.
What happens to it? Are there people who are still scholars of it in the same way that we have Latin scholars and ancient Greek scholars?
It's taken a beating. I know that there are still people in Iran, of course, who try to preserve the language. And they also learn the ancient Avestan language, but the numbers are dwindling. And the West, we also have, unfortunately, a lot of these studies have been stagnating for lack of funds and lack of interest.
But what we're also seeing, I'm getting the feeling, that culture often takes a beating from politics.
Yes.
And in the West as well, if Iran perhaps were more of a darling of more places in the West, then there'd be more scholarship that would be addressed to its ancient culture. But right now, it's a semi-pariah nation, and so
yes,
Nobody really wants to get into it.
Of course, and we won't see movies like Mark Antony's march into northwest Persia, where he was defeated and had to withdraw. I mean, that would be a fascinating movie.
Maybe the Rome series on HBO will deal with that.
Who knows? Who knows?
Instead, what we get is Alexander the Great, in which he comes in and has a terrific time.
That's right. He had a rock and roll tour.
Dr. Kaveh Farrokh, F-A-R-R-O-K-H's book is called Shadows in the Desert, Ancient Persia at Work. It's published by Osprey, and I should point out it has lots of beautiful plates in it, just rich with visuals as well as with text. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. And we're back with Dr. Kaveh Farrokh, who's written a book called Shadows in the Desert, Ancient Persia at Work, published by Osprey. I've been thinking about the tensions between culture and politics, and in Iran they seem to play out more than most places because, for example, when we talk about some of the best filmmaking going on in the world right now. We talk about Iran, and it's despite the fact that the censors are out there checking over every word in every script. So what happens? Is the culture just too rich for anybody to completely homogenize it?
I think that's exactly right. It's the culture is permeated and influenced and been influenced by so many others, like the Greco-Roman, India, China, you know, the Islamic civilization. There's such a strong ancient Persian legacy inside that as well. Again, what I find really interesting, especially about censorship, is the movie 300, for example. There was a lot of protest in the Iranian community. Myself, I think the cinematography was, you know, splendid. Although my objection would be some of the portrayals were not just fantastic, but comical.
Well, it was comic book type movie.
It is a comic book. And, you know, my concerns are, you know, if people take it seriously, what kinds of conclusions will they draw and so on. But what's interesting is you would think in Iran they would actually make some kind of, you know, protest or whatever. And apparently one of the mullahs said, there's no reason to get upset because the history they're talking about never existed.
Well, this book is laid out kind of like a textbook. Are you hoping that this will be adopted by universities that may be interested in the future in looking into this history?
Hopefully generate some interest in the field that's kind of been somewhat downgraded since 1979. Yes, that's part of a hope, let's be honest. Yes, that's part of my hope. But I'm also hoping to reach out to not just professors at the university, but, you know, the general lay people, if you will, who are interested in just getting a synopsis of that past.
Are you surprised by how little is known in the West? I don't know whether the French don't know who the Medes are or the Achaemenids or the Parthians or the Sasanians, but I see those words once in a while in an article.
It's almost
and
like
I think,
obscure.
Okay, they're all some kind of ancient Persian stuff, and then I move on because I have really no frame of reference.
That's right. There's no context because there's a very strong Greco-Roman basis to our society here in the West. And again, a lot of the, I think the history that we see, remember, we're working with translations here. So, for example, we'll see Edward Gibbon's perspective. But there's a lot of other perspectives, again, with historians across the West. I'm thinking of Roman Gershman, for example, of Ukrainian origin who grew up in France. His book was translated to English in 1962, but again, didn't receive much attention.
Where do you research a book like this? You can't go to Iran for it, can you?
Actually, I'm glad you brought up the point. I spoke to a professor once by telephone who teaches in one of the universities, and he was telling me that in his entire university, in the entire library that used to be ancient, pre-Islamic Persian, there are only three books on the shelf.
And the rest are hidden away?
The rest, who knows what's happened? Who knows what's happened?
So let's talk about some of the glories of Persian history. You mentioned the horseback riding.
Yes.
How important is that to the development of the culture?
Well, the notion of mobility, the ability to traverse long distances, the impact on trade, the impact on communications with different cultures, and how people like the Turks would then take the concept of horseback riding and really bring it up to new levels. For example, it was the Turks who invented the stirrup as we know it. So I think I find that people and cultures tend to pick up what others leave off.
Well, initially, it must have given the Persians an advantage as warriors.
Yes.
I think have that, horses when other people didn't.
Yes. The Medes, for example, were never really conquered by the Assyrian Empire. And even though they were a formidable superpower of the time, eventually their battles with the Medes, some would say the Kurds of today, eventually wore down the Assyrians.
What about art?
Tremendous impact. I think that's far more important than the military aspect. The influences in art and architecture, there's been a lot of work that's been done. Mostly it's been published in Italian journals, like people like Mazzarini or Nick Spatari, who had a presentation actually a few years ago here in New York, where there's been noticeable influence, permeation of, quote, Persian arts and architecture on the Greco-Roman civilization. In fact, in Calabria, southern Italy, there's now evidence that there was a Persian colony at the time of Darius that had landed there to set up a trading post. In fact, some of the architecture in Calabria shows that influence, not just Greek. Then you see Roman architecture being influenced by the late Sasanian era. Like there's the Massonzia, Basilica de Massonzio, in one of the pictures in the book. You'll see it was built 100 years after King Ardashir's palace in the 200s.
When we talk about Persian art, we usually think of the Persian miniatures, which
yes.
come along a lot later.
Yes.
And there's no sense of any art before that other than something that kind of looks like Babylonian art.
Well, what's interesting about Persepolis, the city palace, if you will, it was quite innovative because it took elements of not only Babylonian, but Egyptian, Assyrian, Lydian, and so on, but a whole new synthesis kind of is arrived at. The columns, the pillars are totally unique, very distinct. And before the, like if you looked at them, like Egyptian art or Babylonian and so on, look very distinct, but then you have a new sort of synthesis and that went permeated all the way across to the Ukraine, actually.
Were there developments in science and medicine?
Yes. A very dramatic finding in the 1930s by a German archaeological team found evidence of, I don't know if we can call them batteries, but they were like plated electrolytes in a jar. Now, if, you know, whether we can call them batteries, we don't know. 1.5 to 2 volts of power. But there was also...
They could listen to Greek radio?
Well, they probably have to wait 1,400 years, but, you know...
What would they use batteries for?
Mostly electroplating metal works. You'll still see that in a lot of places, workshops in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other... the influences, for example, like the windmill. The Greeks developed a prototype, but they never put it in practice. And it took a long time for the Iranians to put that in practice. But by the early Islamic arrivals, the windmill, for example, had developed. And the final form, actually, the synthesis finally arrived at was in England, not in Holland.
A lot of mathematical advances
yes.
come through India.
Yes.
Did they go through changes when they hit the Persians?
I think more research is required there. What we do know is that the ancient Iranians and the Indians had a lot of, especially with the Gupta dynasty, there was a lot of exchange in mathematics, in musicians, in art forms. What happened in Iran was kind of like what's happening in North America now, where you have scholars converging, like a lot of the Greek scholars who were rejected by Justinian, School of Athens. Came to a university center called John de Shapur, where you had Greek, you had Indian, you had Persian, you had Aramaic working side by side, and that's where a lot of these works were preserved.
Most of Western philosophy comes from the Greeks,
yes.
actually, from the Greeks who were in Asia Minor.
Yes.
Well, what about, since Asia Minor was connected to the Persians as well, what about the development of philosophy?
Well, what we do know is that Greek philosophy was very much preserved and honored by scholarship in the Iranians itself. We do know that Zoroastrian thought, kind of the notion of dualism, developed into a lot of other types of thought, like Manichaeism, which in its extreme form we still see Manichaeism as being the polarity of good versus evil. So there's a very strong theological aspect. But when you look at the philosophy of especially science, for example, there was a notion or understanding of atoms or bits, but to what extent there was confluence between the Greeks and not only the Iranians, but the Babylonians and Egyptians, which goes back to the Achaemenid Empire.
Is part of the problem in respecting this period that the Greeks did develop an incredible art tradition, and there really wasn't one in Persia until much later. In fact, I guess it's the architecture that the glory of Persia is the architecture that comes after Islam comes to the area. But poetry is important. Sufism is
Sufism again. Persia has had so many stages in history. For example, the architecture of Persia probably starts from the time of the Medes, but we have to remember that the very foundation of the West is Greco-Roman, in a sense. So that's been the influence, if you will, across the Aegean. Persian architecture not only existed side by side, people forget that Persepolis was built 100 years before the Acropolis. And there are Persian influences in Greek architecture. We just don't see them.
By 559 BC, the Near East was ruled by four major powers, the Median Empire, the Babylonian Empire, the Lydian Kingdom of Anatolia, and Egypt. Was that the last time that we saw peaceful coexistence in the Middle East?
Well, what had happened was more balance of power. I think they were equally matched, and they had been quite exhausted because, well, I guess with the exception of Lydia and possibly Egypt, Babylon and the Medes, the original Iranian people, with a nomadic Iranian people, the Scythians, had colluded to defeat the Assyrian Empire. They carved up, basically, a huge empire. But they were too exhausted to go at it. The Medes and the Lydians had battles, but it was kind of a stalemate. And when Cyrus came, and again, he finalized the unity of the Iranian peoples, then there was this new vigor, although the vigor wasn't just military, it was ideas to unify people across a charter of human rights, if you will. That was more like a vision.
When Stalin declared modern art to be unacceptable for the Soviet Union, a lot of great paintings, Matisse's and the like, went into hiding, and they came out after the fall of the Soviet Empire. Do you see something similar happening in Iran?
Yes. Like, there was a book that came out by Manoushehr Khorasani, Arms and Armor from Iran. It's a breathtaking book. It's 750 pages, maybe thousands of rare photographs, which he took at his own expense. And what's fascinating about this book is you see rare it starts from the Bronze Age all the way to the pre-Pahlavi era. And what's fascinating about this book is that it's got pictures of rare swords from ancient monarchs and, you know, figures, like the armor, and the fantastic artwork that you see on a lot of, let's say, sword sheaths and so on. And these are now preserved in local areas, including army officers, regular army, I'm not talking about the ideological wing, who keep them in caches or in hiding, almost. And he kind of went around the country talking, like in Iranian Kurdistan and Azerbaijan and so on. And he said it was breathtaking to hold the sword of, let's say, Shah Ismail, for example, of the medieval period. And he said, I could feel the art and the energy. And then they're very careful to preserve these, so they're kind of out of the eyes of the officials.
Well, until recently, it looked like Iran was going to liberalize itself. Instead, it's moved in the other direction with the election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad.
Yes, yes. Ahmadinejad is the ideologue of the original, cut from the original cloth of the Khomeini era. Definitely going back to that philosophy and that time, the ideological Puritanism, and the notion that, maybe this is too strong to say, I don't know how else to say it, but the fact that Iran and its past are secondary or to be sacrificed for the greater good of, you know, the pan-religious, I guess, Islamic sort of unity. In fact, we have to remember that there were ideologues who wanted to ban the Persian language, or Farsi as it's called in Iran, in replacing it with the Arabic language.
But that didn't happen.
That's impossible.
But now Farsi is just one of a number of languages, but it's the language that winds up being the...
That's the common language that... Remember that Iran has been multilingual and multiracial from the very beginning. The official language of commerce in ancient Persia was not Old Persian. It was Aramaic. To this day, I dispute the notion of a race in Iran.
Dr. Kaveh Farrokh, F-A-R-R-O-K-H, his book, Shadows in the Desert, Ancient Persia at War. It's published by Osprey, and it's got lots of wonderful pictures in it. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Great being here in New York.
On tomorrow's show, we hear about a remote Israeli village where everyone communicates through sign language, and then a man who's traveled coast to coast in search of the best eats, from fast food to fine dining, plus a chef who's found a way for vegetarians and omnivores to enjoy the same meals, and a reporter on an icebreaker in Alaska reveals the financial windfall created by global warming and what nations are seeking to exploit the riches. By the way, if you missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs on WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blake Neeschick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Angela Sheldon, Sophie Rand, and Scott Goldberg. Kim Gittleson produced our underappreciated series. Jason Isaac was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.